Hi everyone, welcome back to the Figure It Out podcast. Today I have a very good friend of mine, Tina Ojapian. She is a badass lawyer. She is specializes in brain injuries. She is a fashionista, an influencer. She is a standalone powerhouse as someone I personally look up to and I think and I admire, and I think that everybody would benefit from hearing who she is about and all the things she's able to accomplish at such a young age and with two kids and a husband, and just you do it all. And you know, people always ask me, how do you do it with your kids? And it's like, we all do definitely do have our struggles, but the way she does it looks so effortless. And the fact that you're able to do so much, like you don't say no to anything. And I think you think that you do say no to some, which is like 2% of the 100% of the things you do, but you are able to balance and not let yourself go as far as, like, you know, how you dress. You know, you love eating, the restaurant, spending time with your family, and
right.
and your fashion and your business. And, like, it's just so admirable. And then I'll see you, you know, killing it at a gala. And then the next day you're cutting a check for a client for, like, $2 million. And just, I have so many questions. I have so many questions. And I think my viewers would all benefit from you, male, female, regardless of age, because you just, you've done so much and you continue to do so. So my first question is to you. Who are you, Tina?
First of all, I love you. Thank you so much for that overly generous introduction. It takes one to know one. I look up to you. I admire you. I commend you for everything that you do, and you too make it look effortless, and you're stunning like all the time. I don't know how the hell you
do it.
You do it. But who am I? So I am someone who has been blessed and really fortunate to have good people in my path who support my passion and my dream and help me. It really takes a village to be able to quote unquote do it all, to the extent, you know, that you think I do it all. But you know, I've got a very supportive husband. I've got beautiful, well-behaved, most of the time, kids, mostly because I parent by fear, but that's a whole other story altogether. But, like, you know, and I've got a great team at the office, super, you know, supportive, and really into helping our clients out and you know, just taking care of them at the most difficult time in their lives. So I think that, who am I? Well, first and foremost, I guess I'm a mom. I'm a mom of two beautiful boys. I'm a wife to a really supportive, strong, amazing Armenian man who puts up with me. And I'm an owner of a firm called Ojagian Law Group. We specialize in brain injury litigation. Our scope of practice is basically representing folks who are really badly injured, either in construction accidents, trucking accidents, anything like that, at a time in their life when their life's turned upside down, and we get to come in and be a part of the silver lining. So it's really gratifying. I mean, it's stressful, don't get me wrong, because a lot of times, you know, people's lives are on the line, their well-being, and so that can be kind of stressful and it's a lot of pressure, but it's also a blessing, and I don't take that for granted ever. You know, who am I? I guess I'm also a fashionista just because it's kind of in my DNA. I love fashion. I grew up with a very fashionable, always impeccably dressed grandmother who was also a professional. She was a dentist back a decade ago, and a mom who was also equally, you know, fashionable and elegant. And so just being surrounded by that, I really kind of grew up admiring and looking up to these strong female role models. And so fashion is my passion. It's a hobby. I fashion blog for fun. It's kind of turned into a thing, and it's part of who I am. And at first it was kind of hard to reconcile, you know, the fashion world along with law, because law is such a serious profession. And at least when I was starting out 15 years ago, it was deemed like unlawyerly to have, you know, fashion posts on Instagram and be prancing around and stuff. But, you know, now I think my work and my results and my work ethic speak for itself. And so it's acceptable to have, you know, a fashion blog post one day and then, you know, a result post and, you know, for my law firm giving someone a check the next day, and, you know, and being able to kind of showcase different parts of my life. You know, people always try to pigeonhole you, put you in a little box. And I try to tell young women that I'm mentoring that, you can be whatever you want to be. You don't let other people impose their limitations or beliefs on you. You know, be yourself to the extent that you can, and express yourself in a way that is genuine and authentic and true to yourself, as opposed to trying to mimic somebody else or trying to be something that someone else thinks that you should be. Now I feel like I've really gone on a tangent, but I hope that in a nutshell answers your question.
I get it. It takes a lot to understand who Tina is, because you are doing so much. So that kind of explains a lot, where you never limited yourself. You always stepped outside the box and challenged yourself and did what you want to do. And it's very, following on social media, the authenticity comes through. And I think that's really important for the younger generation now, that hey, like, it's okay to love fashion, but still be serious in your work, and, you know, having humor and humility, which is in your stories with your kids and all of that. So I love that. So let's rewind a little bit about where you were born, and you have several different ethnicities.
So I do.
Give me a little background on Tina.
Okay. Well, I mean, in the intro, you said at such a young age, and I'm flattered and I love you, I'm almost half a century old. I'm aging myself now. I still have some time left, but I certainly have been doing this for you know, at least 2 decades now, the law practice, and I've been around a minute, and it's taken a while to sort of hit my stride, and it's not something that's happened overnight, you know? So, but I appreciate you saying that very much. I was born in London many, many, many years ago, and then immigrated to Iran from there, and lived there for a while until I was 10. My brother was 5 years old, and back then they were prohibiting 5-year-old males from leaving the country because of the Iran-Iraq war. They wanted to have, you know, boys to draft into the army at the young age of like 6 and 7. It was really kind of dangerous and scary. And so my dad decided that it was time for us to move, but he knew that my mom would never agree to it. So he told us that we're going on vacation to the United States to visit my aunt. So we all came in one suitcase back in, you know, in the 80s, in the early 80s, mid 80s. And then we stayed. You know, he told us that we're staying, we're not going back, never went back. We settled in my aunt's basement in the very sort of ethnically homogenous, white country. I mean that in the nicest way, of La Cañada. And so, as you can imagine, that was kind of tough to assimilate, and not the friendliest to Armenian kids back then. And it was a reality check. You know, we came from Iran, where we were, my parents were successful, they were, you know, well respected, we had a good life, to starting from scratch here, you know, at the age of 10. And I think the trauma and the difficulty that brought was also character building. It taught me work ethic, and it's probably responsible for, you know, what I've achieved in life, to the extent I've achieved anything, or where I am today.
Wow, I love that. And your mom and dad, what backgrounds are they from?
So my dad is, his mom is Rusahai. Both his parents are Rusahai.
Russian Armenian
who migrated to Iran, so they speak a little bit of Farsi too. My mom's dad was Portuguese and Indian. He worked for the Winston Churchill administration as an ambassador, because back then Portugal and India were colonies of Great Britain, and her mom was Chaldean, Christian Arab, Lebanese. So, you know, I grew up in a house speaking a bunch of different languages. I never really quite picked up the Arabic, unfortunately, but I get to speak Armenian, Farsi, Russian on a good day, and English. So,
well-versed for what you need.
For what I need. Aside from the Spanglish, I had to pick that up from my clients and my nanny, and that, believe it or not, has been the most useful language to speak here in the States.
And so at what age did you decide you want to be a lawyer, or did you always know you wanted to?
No. So I am that kid that would get in trouble and get sent to the detention hall for wearing lipstick and makeup in class, and, you know, wearing stuff out of my mom's closet, like playing dress up. I was very much into like the aesthetics and style and so forth. And then, I think maybe moving here and being exposed to some prejudice and some difficult times, and watching it happen to others, it instigated something in me that really wanted to stand up for the underdog. And I felt like, you know, the only way to effectively be able to do that is to go to law school. But then again, I was working from the age of, you know, 16, and, you know, school was never a priority because I was trying to help my family make ends meet. And so I think in undergrad, I was flunking out. I had like a 1.67 GPA when I decided I want to go to law school. So I had to really pull it together to be able to get into law school in the first place. But school wasn't a priority. You know, work was a priority back then.
And so you went into law, and did you know you wanted to specifically help victims of brain injury, or were you in a different field? How did you start in the field? What was your experience? Because I feel like a lot of lawyers, they start out, they think they want to be in one field, but then the job market, they get into different fields, and I have friends who wanted to get into civil and they wanted to criminal, like whatever you can get. Like, did you know you wanted to be in this field in particular?
No. So with law school, it's not like med school. You don't specialize, right? So if you're in med school, you know, you're either a cardiology resident or you're going into oncology. But in law school, it's not like that. You just kind of take electives, and based on what you're interested in, what your aptitude is, what you're good at, you kind of fall into it. And then, you know, you're also a victim of the job market, if you will, too. Back when I graduated in 2003, a lot of big firms were going under. You know, I think it was biotech back then was going under. And so all these big firms all of a sudden were dissolving. And I was on the market looking for jobs and competing with attorneys who had been out 10 years, 11 years. So the job market was really, really tough. And it was one of those situations where you kind of take what you can get. I got a civil offer. It was out in OC. You know, I helped support my family here. That wasn't an option for me. So then I took a insurance defense job, which kind of was a little bit bottom of the totem pole, not something that I would have, like, you know, aspired to, to go to in my law school days. It ended up being a great experience and prepared me for having my own practice and practicing on the plaintiff side down the road, because it's important. Now I get to see, you know, where the other side's coming from. I get to, you know, I have some insight as to their intentions, and it helps me represent my client better having been on the other side. But back then it was just like survival mode and getting the best job you can get to be able to pay back your student loans, get that experience, you know, and get some real life experience that you don't get in law school, right? In law school, it's so theoretical. It's just, you have to get in there and get your first job and see, you know, what you'd like, what you don't like, what you excel at. So yeah, it wasn't, I didn't get to specialize. I got an insurance defense job out in Tarzana. I took that for 2 years, and I early on learned that I'm not the type of personality that, you know, I'm very entrepreneurial. I like to work for myself. And I was in a firm of 60 attorneys. I was always one of their top billers, but they couldn't, you know, they would still sort of micromanage and, you know, want me there at a certain hour. And I felt like, you know, I'm a professional. I've gone to law school all this time. I don't appreciate the kind of hovering and the micromanaging. And I really want to have my own autonomy and ability to do what I want and expand. And so 2 years out of law school, I decided to hang up a shingle and start my own practice.
Only 2 years? Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. I mean,
that's
look.
That's entrepreneurship in
me. That's entrepreneurship in me. And look, it's not for everybody though, right? Mm-hmm. It's really difficult to wear all the different hats, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you're at a firm where there's opportunity to excel and there's opportunity for partnership and you see yourself growing with the firm, I'm all for it. But that wasn't the situation I was in. And so it became evident to me early on that if I wanted to excel, I would have to kind of, you know, set my own table, do my own thing. Yeah.
And so you decided to open the firm. And do you guys practice other cases too? Is it specifically just brain injury? That's what I know that's what you specialize in. And you have a team, yes?
Yes.
Tell me about that process. You opened up, or were you by yourself in the beginning?
So I had a partner, and it was someone that I'd gone to law school with, who was good friends with. And I learned early on that just because you're friends with someone doesn't mean they're going to make a good partner, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of a glitch, but it was a, you know, it was a learning experience. It lasted a few years. And then I was solo probably about 12 years ago. And then I started from scratch and went from there. But to answer your question, yes, I'm a big believer. I clerked for a federal court judge named Dick Rentavizian. He's a mentor and a friend of mine. He would always say to me, kid, specialize, so you don't get sued. Don't be jack of all trades, master of none. And so I really always am mindful to try to stick to that. I refer out 95% of what comes through the door because I want to be able to do my clients justice. When I first started out, Macy's was my only client. Macy's and Bloomingdale's came with me.
That's huge.
It is huge, yeah. So.
That's huge. It's great to have them as your only client opening your own first store.
Back then, before they were closing stores, yes, yeah. For sure. And so, you know, I did insurance defense work for them. And but it was one of those things, though, when I would go to sleep at night, I didn't necessarily feel great about the work that I did. And I really felt like, you know, there's got to be more. And my calling is to help people who really need it the most, not necessarily save insurance companies or big corporations money. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so with all due respect to defense attorneys, just my heart wasn't in it. Right. And so I wasn't fulfilled. And at the end of the day, you know, all the school, all this money spent, you want to be able to sleep at night. You want to be able to feel good about what you do. And so we had taken a handful of plaintiff's cases. And I had to kind of, in the divorce proceeding with my partner, concede to give them up to be able to buy my piece and move forward. And then so I started from scratch and started taking on brain injury cases and never really advertised, not back then, not now. Everything's kind of been word of mouth. I was fortunate that people recognized the work that my firm did and the results that we got. And so we started getting, you know, a small number of referrals here and there. And with big catastrophic cases, you don't need a big volume because they're very labor intensive. You want to be able to give them the attention they need to bring them to fruition. And so started getting a small amount of brain injury cases and knocking them out of the park, and then started getting more. And so it kind of grew from there.
What's the largest case you've had?
Oh my gosh. Just under 8 figures, probably. 8.9. We had a result. You know, we've had several in the sevens.
That's insane.
Do
you surprise yourself every time you cut a check so big? Like, you're changing lives, people's lives.
Yeah, that is honestly the best part of my job. Mm-hmm. Is the day that I get to call them and tell them, you know, that we've gotten this result for them and this is how it's going to impact their lives. Listen, I mean, any single one of them would rather not have been in this situation, right? Their lives are forever changed, obviously. But, you know, I can't turn back the time
and you need to change it for the family because the responsibility financially to take care of someone who is unable to take care of themselves is expensive and not always subsidize the best way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It impacts their quality of life for mm-hmm. sure. And keep in mind, a lot of my clients are laborers. They do the heavy lifting. A lot of them are not documented, you know, and so for them, it's a, you know, when you end up saying like $8 million settlement, if they're getting that in an annuity, which oftentimes they are, because it's not wise to hand someone with a brain injury $8 million in cash, right? If they're getting it in an annuity, they're getting their monthly tax-free payments of like $30,000, $40,000, you know, that ends up being well over $10 million for their life expectancy, right? So it really does change lives. I think sometimes some of them have not seen that kind of money before and don't quite really understand the impact it's going to have, but you know, we stay in touch with our clients. They reach out to us years later, months later. You know, they pray for us. They're super gracious, super kind. I've been blessed with some really amazing clients. And so that is the best part of my job. I used to host like brain injury support groups at my office and my kids would come. And my clients, like wives would tell my kids, you know, your mom's a superhero. She changed our lives, so on and so forth. And the look on my kids' face is like priceless. That is why I do this job, mm-hmm. you know, so.
So what I wanted to know is, do you have a case where, I mean, what was your most, do you get attached to your case? Like, do you, not cases, to the people attached to the case?
Very much so.
Attached? Do you take it home?
Very much so. In fact, it's like a running joke at my office that, you know, if there's a case we're on the fence about taking, because we only take about, not, you know, 5%, maybe 4% of what comes through the door, is don't have Tina meet with them. Because if Tina meets with them, she's a sucker. She'll
take it all. And then you're going to drown.
Right, right. So, I mean, imagine that's without even, you know, not even knowing the client well. But I'm very personally involved in my clients' lives. I'm kind of like an attorney and a case manager and, an older sister and whatever I need to be to the wife, to the kids, to kind of help them through it. I give my clients my cell phone number. They have access to me in cases of emergencies, which I know some colleagues don't or don't agree with. I really think that, you know, a brain injury is a life-changing occurrence. It's not like a sprained ankle or broken elbow. And it's an invisible injury. By and large, when you see my clients, you're going to think they're fine. A lot of times judges will make comments when I walk them in with the settlement and say, but he looks fine. Like, and then look at the amount, like, this is insane, right? This is a lot of money. They're walking and talking on their own. But, you know, the things that have changed are mind-blowing and they're maddening. So they have symptoms like memory loss, constant ringing in the ear, constant chronic headaches, you know, split personality, depression, anxiety, all of it. And it's things that you can't see on the surface, right? And so I'm very intimately involved in their case and in their lives because they require that kind of support and the cases require that kind of attention to bring them to fruition and get the results that we get. So for that reason, I get very attached to my clients.
What is one case that stands out to
you? There's so many of them.
I know you do so many, but is there
I want
to paint a picture if you're able
to
share.
Yeah, absolutely.
What type of...
Okay. There is one in particular. It's still ongoing, so I will share bits and pieces of it, but I have I've come to really love this family, and I'm friends with the mom, and it's kind of really a gut-wrenching case. I had a young client who was 19 years old at the time. He was an aspiring sports writer. He had an internship, kind of like a PA job with Fox Sports. And he showed up to work one day with his gym bag in one hand and a pressed iron shirt in the other hand, getting ready to change out of his gym clothes, high-fiving colleagues, full of energy. And then throughout the day, you see in the surveillance cameras that his energy is dwindling. He's looking kind of frustrated, kind of leaning against the wall. My client was diabetic, and he somehow fell from the fifth story of Fox Sports down to the floor and almost died.
Through
the stairwell, inside the stairwell, and no one knows how he fell. There is no footage, miraculously, for that 2 seconds or 2 minutes, rather, before the fall. There were no witnesses before the fall, just the folks that found him down below in a pool of blood with his concave skull. And so, you know, Fox denied the workers' comp claim on that case. And my client was left to, you know, for his mother to take care of near death, you know, wherever they can get him into. Grandpa helped. Everyone pitched in. There was a GoFundMe sort of a situation, and Fox took the position that they're not going to pick it up because somehow my client was horse playing around or had attempted to self-inflict this harm. Fast forward, it was 2.5 years of like gut-wrenching discovery, chasing down the police report, you know, all sorts of theories as to what may have happened. And we went to trial. It was a 7-day trial before a Van Nuys judge, and the court found that it happened in the course and scope of employment. There was no horseplay. There was no attempted suicide, and found the case to be compensable. Now, they have appealed. We've won on the first layer of appeal, and they have now made an appeal to the California Court of Appeals. And so we're waiting on that decision. In the interim, though, there's court hearings set on sanctions and the conduct of the defendants. But this is one of the worst cases I've ever seen, where there's no civil liability, but workers' comp should have been a no-brainer. Those benefits should have been provided. And for 3 years, this family has been left to deal with this person, this poor kid on their own. So the mom was a teacher. She had to quit her job because she takes care of him 24 hours. She gets up, sets an alarm every 2 hours at night to get up and rotate her son so he doesn't get bed sores. Every half hour, she's having to take the wheelchair up and down so he doesn't choke because he's a choke hazard. I mean, just the most gut-wrenching case you could ever see. And this is a case now that keeps me up at night. I'm hoping that justice will prevail, as it has been, but it just kind of gives you the idea of the types of cases that we get to work on.
And is his brain functioning at all, or?
So he's semi-vegetative, but he does respond to some stimuli. he was doing a lot better, but he had an infection and had to get another bone flap surgery that kind of made him regress a little bit. But, you know, he is semi-vegetative, but according to the doctors, he can understand, he can respond to stimuli, but he can't really emote or speak or anything like that. It's really difficult. You know, the visual of seeing the photos and the videos of him before.
I think you posted and it was so hard, but I couldn't even look at the photo.
Yeah.
It was so hard.
Yeah, it's really difficult to watch.
Young boy.
He's 22 now. This ordeal's been going on for 3.5 years.
Do you use social media at all for helping with the, you know, winning of the cases? Do we have anything like, not that social media is going to help them win their case, but, you know, social media is now used to picket against anything in these large corporations being able to, you know, take advantage of these situations and not take responsibility. And do you use that at all, or do you keep it separated? Because I know
I share a lot, but within the confines of like attorney-client privilege and, you know, and confidentiality, to the extent that some results and some things are confidential. But I definitely use my microphone on social media to raise awareness. So I'll give you an example. We've been published probably in 6 or 7 cases the past 2 years where my firm has won really great results that, you know, others can kind of refer to in their own cases, you know, to potentially win an argument. Yeah. So I'll post about that, and I'll post like case citations and summaries about what the propositions of what those cases stand for my colleagues to be able to use in their cases. I use it for that. I do use it sometimes to exert pressure, but I think, you know,
because of the sensitivity. Do you think a majority of your followers are interested in the fashion, or do you think they are aspiring lawyers?
You know,
you have a balance of both.
I'll tell you, the last time I checked, I was really proud that about 70% of my followers are female. And they're between the ages of 25 and 45. And I would answer, say, sadly, fashion. But, you know, I think that, you know, it's probably a mixed bag.
It helps pull in the eyes
right.
and the viewers, right?
Right, right. So one of the themes in my social media that I really try to stress as a first generation immigrant kid that was left young to my own devices at sort of a young age and really struggled with self-confidence and self-worth, you know, I try to really stress and impress upon young women to be independent and to do things that are going to be able to grow their value, their self-esteem, their feeling of self-worth, their ability to stand on their own 2 feet and provide for themselves down the road and have a sense of pride and ability and aptitude, and focus more on inner growth than, you know, than necessarily outer beauty, which is, you know, it's really important. But I remember back then, my biggest worry was, oh my God, looking at the cover of Bazaar and Us Weekly and seeing this unrealistic image and comparing myself and feeling like shit. But now I think, you know, young women contend with that everywhere they turn, like on social media, on just everywhere. And it's really easy to, if you're already not in a good place, have that affect you negatively. And so I try to kind of, be a positive influence and be uplifting and empowering and make them feel like they have the ability to effectuate change in their own lives. And so I think I set an example, hopefully for those young women who are thinking, you know, maybe they want to do something, maybe they want to go to law school, maybe they want to take that chance, they want to put themselves up for that promotion, but they just don't know how, kind of help them find their voice a little bit. But yeah, the majority of my followers are female, so it's hard to say. You know, when I see them and I have the opportunity to meet them sometimes on a weekly, daily basis, they'll say, you know, we love how you do it all. And, you know, we love the fashion, but we love the boss vibes and stuff. So I think, you know, kind of like you, Lil, you know, we appeal to young women who have dreams and hopes, and we kind of give them, you know, an example and show them that they can do it. They can do it if they set their mind to it. And
you're definitely a woman's woman.
Yeah.
You know, girl's girl, woman's woman. You're so supportive with those around you, whether it's your team, your office. Like, I know I had an issue one time, you saw it and you quickly picked up the phone, you felt like, what can I do? explain to me what, I was like, I'm good. You're like, girl, tell me what I need to do. Tell me what happened. Any details? And any, do you need me to come over? Do you need, like, you were just like, it's so impressive. It really is impressive because you do have a lot going on, but you still make time for the people around you that, you know, you care about or you know that care about you. And whether it's, I know you also have a group. Stilettos and something.
Mm-hmm. Lawn Stilettos. Lawn Stilettos.
Lawn Stilettos. I love the name.
My girls.
It's also like a support group, right? In order to help each other succeed and
absolutely
know, this stressful career that you're all in.
I love you. Thank you for saying that. No, look, I love and I support my friends, but with the same token, I'm blessed to have amazing and supportive friends like you. I mean, you are so busy and you go out of your way to like help me and accommodate me when I'm having I'm so
love you so much. I can't say no. I love you so much.
So, you know, it's a two-way road. I'm blessed with a village of people. And look, I have guardian angels in my path, Lil. Sometimes I stop and think, like, how the hell did I get here, right? I mean, you know, we went from living in my aunt's basement to social services coming and wanting to remove us from the house because we were left unsupervised at a very young age to, like, somehow here. And then I think of, you know, like, friends, parents, and aunts. You know, a law school professors, you know, so many people like guardian angels that have kind of helped me on my path. And so I swore that if I ever got, you know, anywhere, that philanthropy would be a big part of my life and paying it forward and helping others would be a big part of my life. So, of course, why wouldn't I do that with my friends and loved ones and people that are closest to me and my team at the office? You know, I'm so fortunate. A lot of my team members have been with me a long time. My office manager has been with me for over a decade in a day and age when, you know, some offices can be revolving doors. So I'm very, very fortunate. I'm blessed with like loyal and good friends. And I try to reciprocate. Lawn Stilettos is a great, great group and an outlet that just came out of COVID. It's one of those great things that was born out of the shit that, you know, was COVID, right? There was a clubhouse group because we couldn't come out of our house. My girlfriend Karina started a clubhouse group of women and like 15 attorneys and then 100 attorneys and Tina, you got to get on here. So I did. And I was starting my own female group and I'm all about collaboration over competition. Right. And so I said, you know, Karen, why don't we join forces and do this together? So her and I, and our other friend, Karima Gulick, who's a powerhouse in her own right. Also, she's one of these IT attorneys who's also like a pilot and like super, like understands engineering and all the shit that goes over my head. And so the three of us got together and kind of grew Lawn Stilettos. And now I think we've got over 1,000 members and we've got a lot of big things coming in, you know, this year and next year, hopefully, like retreats and support groups and coaching. And, you know, because look, I try to do everything I can, but like you, I'm slammed. I get, you know, 100 DMs a week, maybe more sometimes. And I do my very best to answer them at 1 or 2 in the morning and support whoever I can, however I can, but I'm not always successful and I don't always get to it, but I feel like if it's more organized through Lawn Stilettos, at least I can get to my mentees who are aspiring attorneys or law students and do it in a more kind of organized fashion to make sure that I get to everyone and I get to make the most amount of impact with my time. But yeah, there's Lawn Stilettos, there's Brain SoCal, that's a nonprofit dedicated to brain injury education and resources. That I started with some colleagues a few years ago. And then there's the other causes out in the community like you that, you know, that I like to support and bring attention to, whether it's a cause in the Armenian community. And sounds like we have one of those every day. You know, we had the lovely incident day before yesterday with those hateful posters that were put up all over Beverly Hills. And so there's always a call to action and something that really deserves our full attention. And, you know, you and I, we have limited bandwidth, so we have to do the very best we can to make the hugest impact we can in an organized fashion, and that's a daily struggle for me.
And I love that you balance it all on social media as well. Like as an entrepreneur, you are able to. Okay, so I have a friend who is in the law, and I was like, you need to get up on your social media. You need to like. I don't know it. I don't like. And then I was wondering, like, how do you get people interested to follow a law page, right? Because it's like, we'll follow fashion, right? We'll follow, I don't know, beauty and all these things, but to follow business pages are very difficult. Like it needs, like the average person is looking like, ah, that's interesting, I'm gonna follow.
Right.
So And I thought about you and how, although you love fashion and all of that, and you could have kept that separate, but you brought it together, and it really does, you know, it's such a great business mind where you kind of use that as an opportunity to gain the attention for your firm and to be able to be so busy. And you provide so many jobs. Like you said, you refer out so many of your, I think it's amazing. And you're able to, you do all of your social media on your own.
So I do, and there's a reason for that. I really want to, because I think that once you hand over the reins to somebody else, especially in content creation, you lose authenticity, and people have a BS detector, and they see right through that. And no one, like you said, wants to follow a generic page. It's uninteresting. It's generic. And so I have a business page, believe it or not, and it's almost dormant. No one cares about that. They want to relate to the person, to the persona behind the page. And you know, I want to be authentic and give people access to all different components and aspects of my life, right? Because you don't want to project an image of, you know, perfection. You want it to be as realistic as possible for social media, within reason, obviously, right? So for example, if I'm having a bad day or if I lost on something, I make it a point to post about that too, because I'm mindful that there are people that are consuming this content that, you know, may not be in the best place. And you don't ever want to make people feel alienated or isolated or like they're alone. You want them to understand that we're all in the same boat. You know, depression, anxiety, stress, good days, bad days are all part of the human condition. And so I make sure that my page adequately reflects all of that as authentically and as honestly, you know, as possible. But as far as like having a generic business page, I honestly think it's pointless. If I'm being really frank, I just really put all of my heart and my effort into my personal page, because I feel like, you know, people want to see the person behind the page. They want to know who they're going to represent them, you know, who they're entrusting with their case, as opposed to another generic faceless page with a bunch of, you know, pre-manufactured content that no one gives a shit about. So I'm all about personalizing. I bank my content, whether it's like 1 or 2 in the morning, I bank my posts, you know, if I've got a day where I've got some time. And then I kind of release it sort of on a schedule, and I make it a point to interact authentically as much as possible. My assistant helps me with some of that, but most of it I do myself.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. So when I first deleted my Instagram, my personal Instagram, I mean, I was hesitant. I mean, I've been wanting to delete my personal Instagram because, you know, it goes back to the whole fulfillment.
Yeah.
I just didn't, you know, social media has come a long way, and it was kind of draining me, draining my energy throughout the day, and
yeah.
I love sharing and connecting, but it was like the exposure doesn't always welcome, you know, the type of
100%
support you're expecting. So for me, I was like, I don't want to be exposed to this anymore, and I debated whether it would affect my businesses or not.
Yeah.
So, but what ended up happening is like I brought me and my personality to the business pages.
There you go.
And now, you know, and now the brand pages aren't faceless. There is a personality behind it.
There you go.
I'm connecting with them, with people who actually care about what I have to say, whether it's beauty or like just makeup tips or whatever it is, and be able to like say, hey, how are you guys? There's a personality and a person behind this brand that you guys see as a cosmetics or like a business page. And it's shifted a lot,
yeah,
and positively shifted my business a lot positively, because it doesn't have that like I said, no one's following this beauty page just to like be nosy about, you know, whatever it is I'm doing throughout the week. People who are actually interested in my skill, my business. I also give behind the scenes like business advice. How we do production. This is how we test products. This trend going around is accurate. This trend going around is not accurate. And it's crazy. Yeah, you have to have a personality behind your business, whether you shift your business to a personal, whether
yeah.
you take your personal and bring business into it. It's definitely like a combination of two.
That absolutely. I'm not going to lie. I miss seeing your face on social, but I was very excited the past few weeks that I've seen more of your face on the LC pages. And the tutorials and, you know, the up and coming events and stuff. I'm definitely really excited about that. And I'm glad you decided to do that. And in that same vein, I have to tell you, look, I get trolls. I get haters. You know, some of them are faceless. Some Some of them are you know, little men who are titans in the legal community who are maybe threatened by a woman in my position. And, you know, just depending on the day, I take it really hard or I let it roll off. But, you know, I've been dealing with one in the past few months. It's been really kind of awful. They even commented on my social media and how it's unprofessional and it's obnoxious and so on and so forth. And just, you know, Adeline, stuff that is so immature for men of that age and stature that it kind of makes you wonder, like, where their mental health's at, that they're so easily triggered by a successful woman showing her stuff on social media. And if they're so triggered by it, why are they watching it, right? But, right. You know, people have issues and you can't internalize their issues. You just have to realize that they're projecting their own shit onto you and it's got nothing to do with you. And that's a daily struggle for me. So
your kids understand social media and what it is?
Unfortunately, yes. So my little one hates it. His food videos are probably more popular than my fashion videos. I know he's such a chunker. He's got such appetite, but he doesn't like that I post him. But then when we're out and about and people tell him, you know, how cute he is and how they love his videos, then all of a sudden I see him perk up and all of a sudden he likes it. So I struggle with him a little bit. The older one's easygoing, but, you know, he does say things like, hey, mom, you know, did people like that video and so on and so forth. And I'm mindful to teach them from now that it doesn't matter whether people like it or not. Yeah. It doesn't matter whether people comment or not, or how many people liked it or didn't or whatever, because I don't want them to be programmed to assess their self-worth based on, you know, how a piece of content is received. So it's a fine line between using the positive components of social media and limiting your kids and yourself, quite frankly, right, from the negative components of it.
Yeah, I'm sure you get that type of thing too.
All
the
time.
I had my kids' page too, and I mean, they have the most amazing followers. I don't want to call them fans. The kids aren't doing anything. Like they're just there. You know, they're not. It's not a brand.
They're cutely existing.
Yeah, and people would really like look forward to that, and then. On social media, and I'm like, well, I'm mindful of what I'm sharing now as well. So do you get anything like that, and what do you have to say to that?
I get that all the time, and look, I struggled with it too. There's a lot of creeps and weirdos and freaks out there, and you have to kind of be careful. I don't post things in real time. Mm-hmm. I don't like people knowing my location. There's always like a delay or, you know, whatever I need to do to make sure that I'm safe. You know, I've listed my primary residence. Currently it's for sale. And so I'm not living in it because I just don't want there to be that kind of access to my location, to my kids' location. And so I'm mindful of that. But as far as, you know, them seeing my kids or sheltering my kids, look, it's the wave of the future. And you know, it's one thing to want to shelter your kids from that, but it's another thing to kind of prepare them for what's coming. And if they can have a head start and I can help them in some way, provide them with some sort of a, you know, some sort of a stepping stone, then why not? You know, if I had that kind of head start, you know, or if you had that kind of head start, imagine what it would have done for us and our professions and our careers. I mean, we've been fortunate, we've done very well, but this is the way of the future. And this is what our kids are going to be up against and competing with. And I struggle because I'm not super tech savvy, right? And I have to have my assistant or call on my office manager. And, you know, and a lot of the shit goes over my head, but I want to make sure that I'm raising kids that are savvy and, you know, and attuned with the way things work around them. And social media is the real world, and social media is a big part of that.
Where do you see yourself 10 years
from now? Where do I see myself 10 years from now?
One is too far, five is too quick.
Yeah, 10 years from now, on a beach somewhere.
Okay.
You know, I say that to my husband. I say, you know, 3-4 more good years and I'm out. And he just looks at me and laughs and says, you know, funny enough, he retired.
He knows you too. Well.
I know. He retired. I love what I do. And I'm not the type of personality that can do nothing. I have to be busy and feel productive and feel, you know, like I'm doing something. And I just, you know, for example, he's retired now. He helps me run my practice and he manages our real estate. He does, you know, more active like real estate investments as opposed to the passive stuff we were doing before, but he retired from dentistry at 42. And so back when he was working, if I would take like a week off or something, I would fucking drive him crazy because I'd call him like 1,000 times a day. And he's like, dude, you do not, You do not know how to be retired. You're going to be bored out of your mind, right? So I don't think that I would be retired. I think I would maybe be more mindful and selective, and maybe have a slightly slower pace and focus on wellness more, and you know, take care of myself more. I feel like as an Armenian first generation woman, I've always been taking care of others, whether it's my parents or my kids or my husband or my clients. And sometimes, you know, my own well-being falls by the wayside, and I really don't want to take my health for granted and want to make that a focus. And part of that is going to be lightening my load and doing more of what I enjoy. For example, you know, I went to Paris Fashion Week last year. I'm going to make it a point to go every year because it feeds my soul. It's my hobby. It's my passion. And so I need to make allocation for myself to do stuff like that, that makes my heart sing more. And so, you know, more time for myself.
Do you feel like, I guess it would be within your office, you have been training your assistants and your, you work with other lawyers within your office as well.
Yeah.
And you feel like they're on the right path, that should you decide to leave this path, that they would they would take over and kill it the way you do? Like, are you like
they,
subconsciously training them?
They better. No, I'm just kidding.
Listen, what you deal with on a daily basis.
Right. Look, I mean, I'm not an absentee. I couldn't be an absentee boss. If I took on the responsibility, I'm mindful that people are entrusting me with their cases. I've got an amazing team of three attorneys. One of them just joined. She's got 10 years of experience in solo practice, but she gave that up to come join my team, which honestly means a lot. And I've got two attorneys that I've trained from scratch myself. So I have an amazing team, and my case managers are freaking just as genius as my attorneys because they know the cases and the clients and the way that I operate so well. They've been with me for a decade, most of them. And so, you know, I've got a great team in place. And since COVID, we are equipped to do most of our work remotely. And I've been doing that. For example, I've got one of my attorneys who is in trial on a very important medical treatment issue at 1:30, and he knows that I'm on standby to jump on Zoom with a judge if I need to. And so there are ways, especially post-COVID, to run my practice with less physical, less need for physical presence on my part. But to answer your question, yeah, I mean, I've got a team of 15, who most of whom have been with me for a long time, and this attorney that's joining is a good friend of mine. So, you know, I'm very blessed in that I'm very supported. My clients are very supported. What, you know, 5 or 10 years from now is going to look like for my involvement, I don't know. It really depends on a lot of things. I was invited to join a group called the Vogue 100, which is super exclusive. It has to do with fashion connoisseurs. Anna Wintour kind of put it together from Vogue. It's through Condé Nast publications and stuff. So that's going to be taking up some of my time, going to some events and doing stuff like that. So, you know, maybe writing a column somewhere, maybe, you know, doing something like that. More philanthropy. You know, I find myself saying no to some things that I really feel passionate about and having the ability to do that. And just, you know, being able to have a little more autonomy over my time and training myself, honestly, a little to say no more. But I do have an amazing team, and I can't stress that enough. I'm very fortunate, and I feel comfortable being there physically less when they are there. And, you know, my clients have access to me telephonically via Zoom, and the results speak for themselves. You know, ever since COVID, a lot of our court hearings have been on Zoom, not in person. And unless it's a jury trial, you know, if it's a bench trial in front of a judge, we've been able to do our trial work on Zoom. The Jack Rieger trial I was telling you about against Fox Sports was a 7 or 8 day trial on Zoom. I called witnesses on Zoom, and we won, and we were able to do that. And so we've come a long way. Yeah.
So what's one thing that you wish you knew before?
One thing I wish I knew before, I've said this 10 times, and maybe I sound like a broken record now, is I wish I knew that I have what it takes, that I am enough, that everything will work out as it should. I wish I knew to trust myself more, to have faith, to be less afraid. And that's all I can say. I can't stress that enough. You know, when experience gives you the self-confidence of knowing you've been through it and you can get through it. As someone who's young and starting out, you don't have that. So you have to do what it takes to fake it till you make it so that you yourself believe you've got what it takes. Because if you believe it, you can make other people believe it. So affirmations, I'm all about affirmations in the mirror. I still do them. I do them with my kids who are 8 and 10. To rewire some of those, you know, neurotransmitters in the brain that you know, breed self-doubt with self-confidence. I wish I knew that I have what it takes to knock it out of the park.
Beautifully said. I can hear you talk all day. You are so articulate.
I love
you. Have so much to say. And you're just so entertaining to listen to.
I am a clown. This is true.
No, you are not like, but you are like my friend Arpina. Like, she's so funny. Why are
she's
lawyers
the
so
best.
Funny? Why are lawyers
okay,
funny?
RP is whole other level,
no,
though.
No, you
like,
guys
she's
are
hilarious.
Both, like, boss women killing it in the business you're in, but then you're just hilarious. People don't really know how funny you guys are. I don't know what it is. It's like this creative outlet you guys have, or like, it's built in you, and it's like a personality trait that.
It's quick wit with the need to blow off steam and humor being the best way to do that.
There you go. There's going to be some explanation
to
that. But this was beautiful. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
So many women and men who listen to you benefit from this. And, you know, hopefully we'll chat with you several years down the line when you're having to pull out on the beach.
Yes. I look forward to it. It was a pleasure as always. I love you. Thank you for having me.